some of the things that we've seen so far could be fit into some categories or some existing structures. And to kind of segue from there into Kol Olam Dvar, as you saw, the Maamar Komos that were given today mostly focused on that issue. So we'll get into that today and more tomorrow, probably. And then by Wednesday, also to fill in some discussions about the Shul of the Daini and Yehi Munach and the like, and to try to see how they all come together so that we can go to Yontif with some sense of perspective on this whole sugya. So when we left off last week, you know, it's been a few days, so we had tried to understand what Yachloku is getting at, what it's addressed to. Is Yachloku a genuine division? Is it a division made out of suffix? Is it a type of compromise, if you want to use that word, or is it a type of pshara? Is it an actual din? All kinds of different permutations. And a lot of that tied into the question also of, are we dealing with muhzakim here? Are we dealing with people who have any genuine claim to what they're holding on to? They have an actual muhzak status, they have some lesser status, but status nonetheless. And how does that play into the decision to divide it between them? And when we ended off last week, we were focusing on the Riva. And the Riva, who Tosfos and Baba Basra, had made two important points. One point that he didn't think that Yachloku requires Ochzin. Right, that was the Riva against Rabbeinu Tam. Tosfos and Baba Basra had asked that fundamental question that animates everything. How come sometimes we say Yachloku, sometimes we say Kol Olam Gavar, sometimes we say something else? And Rabbeinu Tam had said, well, it's all about Ochzin. If you have Ochzin, you do Yachloku. And the Riva didn't focus on Ochzin. He said you could do Yachloku even without Ochzin, as long as what? As long as there's no Rama. So that itself was interesting, but then he went on to say something else. He said, you know what? If you do have Ochzin, then you can do Yachloku even if there is a Rama. And that really forced us to say, as many Achronim fleshed out, that there probably are at least two different types of Yachloku, at least according to the Riva. Right? There is a Yachloku that is somewhat of a compromise, doesn't necessarily reflect any genuine din. And if you say that you don't need Ochzin, you don't need any type of a claim on each side, so you probably have to say at most it's a pshat. If you could have Yachloku without any type of achiza, any type of each party holding on to something, at most you'd have to say that that's something like a pshat. But then the second category, that if you do have Ochzin, then you can do it even with a Ramai. So then, as we know, it probably means that the Ochzin gives you a genuine status, gives each party some type of real claim, and that's enough to give it to them, despite our reluctance to support Ramayim. Despite the fact that we generally have an issue, if there's a liar present, we have to figure out what that issue is, but it's not going to stop us from giving each one his due. So that was essentially where we had ended off last week. So just to continue with that idea and to maybe see some applications and to throw out some cases and see how they fit in. So coming off of that perspective, so one thing we had mentioned was the Rambam. Right, the Rambam probably sees Yachloku as what? Probably as some type of a pshar. Right, how do we come to that conclusion? Mostly because, a couple of possible sources, but mostly because of his statement about the arema, about the pile of wheat. Right, what did the Rambam say? You have two people standing next to a pile of wheat. So we have Yachloku there. Even though we don't really have a chazaka, we don't have anybody holding on to anything. as the Shach and others in the Bach had noted. So apparently the Rambam is willing to have Yachloku, even in a case like that, so it's probably a Pshara, according to him. So keeping that in mind, we also saw, if you saw the Maamar Kamos already from the previous page, a little bit of excellent synergy action, and because there is a Gemara from Elu Metzias that we have to try to fit in. So it's a Gemara that focuses on the concept of Simanim, so since we're getting exposed a little bit to Elu Metzias on Sunday, it's a good opportunity for some synergy. And so what did the Gemara say on Daf Chav Ches, Bav Metzia? What happens if you have a conflict due to what happening? Two people come to claim the lost object, and they both have Simanim. So if one person came with Simanim, you could give it to him. But what if two different people come with Simanim? What's the din in the Gemara? Yehi Munach. You can't give it back to him. So Rabbi Akiva Eger and the others asked a question on that. Why is this not a Yachloku case? Why shouldn't we say Yachloku? Especially if, let's say we're Rabbeinu Tam, and we look for Ochzid, right? But we found Tosfos on Daf Beis and Bava Metzia wrote that when you have a third party watching something on behalf of two parties, that's called Ochzid, right? And that Tosfos in the beginning of the Masechta, the Tosfos thought that Mana Shlishi should be a case of Yachloku, where you have a Shomer watching something on behalf of the two parties. So even though they have somebody else doing the holding on to it, that's still called Ochzid. So why don't we say here too? Yeah, the Shomer Aveda, he's Ochzid on behalf of the two of them. And why don't we also throw in that you could even say Chaluki Yecholi Osemes. And here's something interesting, because remember we talked about, you have to figure out if Chaluki Yecholios Emes and Ramai are the same thing. And we saw that maybe they're not the same thing. Sometimes you have no Ramai, but it's impossible for it to be Emes. Sometimes it's possible for it to be Emes, but there definitely is a Ramai. In this case, there is no definite Ramai, and it could be Emes, but they're on two different tracks. Why? Because it is possible that it's MS, it's possible that they jointly own this item. That's not what they're claiming. So the MS is not going to line up with their claim. But it could be MS. And they're not necessarily lying either. Because each one has simanim. Maybe each one lost an item that was similar to this. So maybe each one really thinks it is. Each one is really telling the truth, bringing simanim towards an item. It happens to be they both lost the same type of iPhone in a blue case. So they both came and said, I lost an iPhone in a blue case, and they're both telling the truth. So it's interesting, right? Chaluki Yecholios Emes, and there's no definite Ramai, but they're not in the same track. That it's not that their claim could lead to them both owning it. But you have both coexisting. It could be MS. There's no definite Ramai. There's Ochsen by a third party. So why don't we say Echlo? That was Rabbi Akiva Eger's question. While you're at it, you could throw in a third case that the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Samechei brings the following situation. Let's say you have a shtar that is being watched by a third party on behalf of a lender, we'll call him Mel, and a borrower, we'll call him Louis. So Mel claims the debt has not yet been paid, and Louis claims it has been already paid. And normally, if the shtar was in the hands of Mel, it's because it hasn't been paid yet. That's why he gets to hold on to it as a claim. If it had been paid, it would be in the hands of Louis. He gets to keep it once he paid for it. So what's it doing in the hands of a third party? So we don't know how that reflects on anything. So we have a suffix. And there also you have a ruling of Yehei Munach. So you could say there also, maybe we should say Yachloku, because once again it's Ochzer, it's being held on behalf of the parties by somebody else. And it is Yecholios Emes, because it could be that the borrower, that Louis, paid back half of it. So maybe if you split it 50-50, maybe that really would reflect the actual breakdown of things. So why don't you say Yechloku there? So, considering all these cases, we try to...
In the case of the Shar, it's not exactly the same as the other one.
Right, so there is probably a rabbi there, so it's not as perfect as the Aveda case. But the Aveda case is just interesting because you also have the possibility that there's no rabbi and the possibility that it's MS, even though they don't line up with each other.
Did you say about the case of the Shtar?
The case of the Shtar, so you have Ochzen, if you follow Tosfos' view of Ochzen, right? Tosfos on Daf Beis that the Shomer is called Ochzen. And you have also the possibility that it's MS, because it could be that Louis paid back half of it. So, Ochzen and Yecholios Emes, that meets some standards for Yachloku. So why don't we say Yachloku there? So some of these points were addressed. There's an article by Rav Aaron Avram Yaffin, Navardika Rashid, Rashiva Beis Yosef, Navardik. Again, you don't have to feel such a Christ to remember every name that I quote, but you want to properly give credit where credit is due. So Rav Avram Yaffin discusses this in a journal. There's a sefer which I don't even have access to even, but there's a, I guess it's probably one of the library, but there's a sefer called Netzer Matai, which is a sefer Zikaron, which has a lot of articles on Bav Metzia. So in this volume, so Rav Avram Yaffin discusses some of those points. And he notes that presumably, as we said before, Yachloku comes in two forms. It's probably a Yachloku that is a genuine division al pi din, and there is a Yachloku that is less so. Because presumably, Ochzen comes in two different forms too, even if we focus on Ochzen against the Riva. But we still have room to see a couple of possibilities. That there's different types of holding on to things. Right, that's what we discussed last week, that we're not sure just how significant it is that each party is holding on to the talis, because there are different kinds of achiza. Sometimes there's an achiza, somebody's holding on to something, and it's really an anan sadi. We are edim to the fact that he owns it. And sometimes it's not as much as that. It's not necessarily that his holding on to it really convinces us that he owns it, but it's enough to give us an issue. It's enough to give us something we have to deal with. And then we're forced into making a pshara to deal with these two parties because each one has some type of a stake. So it makes sense to say, again, the two types of Yachloku, but this is going beyond the Riva. Last week we said that the Riva is counting Yachloku, we don't even have Ochsin. But even if you have Ochsin, you still can see different levels of Ochsin. You can see a real Mukhzak, and you can see Ochsin that is less convincing, but still forces us into a position where we need to deal with it and we need to make up Shara. We mentioned on day one that it's an interesting thing to think about when we think about these Gemaras and all about these concepts, Yachloku, Kol Olam Dvar, Shuda Dedaini. Are there Makoros in the Torah for any of this? It seems like it's all essentially Svar, which drove us to try to figure out what exactly is our goal before we can have the Svar. So we have to figure out what we're trying to accomplish in order to see what winds up with the Svar. So it's not clear if any of this has a mukkah, right? Does the Gemara attach any psukim to any of these dinim? So the truth is, in all of our different permutations, if you remember the Radbaz, we talked about the six different levels of Yachloku and Kol Dal Mivar and Shudvodaini and Yehei Munach and Sumchas and Chachamim and Motsi Bechaber Lovaraya. Is there a pasuk quoted in connection with any of those dinim? The answer is yes, one of them. and it was on the Mamar Komos, I think, a few days ago, there's at least one possible case where one of those dinim is associated with a pasuk. What am I talking about? Hamotzi Michaver Ol Varayim. That's the Gemara in Bava Kama, and Daf Mem Vav Mid Beis. So the Gemara wants to figure out what exactly is the makor for Hamotzi Michaver Ol Varayim. And the Gemara says, so as Gemara was on the Mamar Komos at one point, says, what do you want to know? Why do you ask if it's what the makor is? It's a svara. This is also a svara, like everything else possibly. This is also a svara. That somebody who's sick, says the Gemara, somebody who's sick goes to the doctor. Somebody who has something which he thinks can be addressed, so he comes and he deals with it. He brings his proof. So presumably, somebody who wants to be mochsim and a mochsim needs to bring a brayah. Then the Gemara does suggest a pasuk. The pasuk in Sefer Shmos, mi bal dvarim yigash aleihem. The Gemara interprets the pasuk saying, whoever has an issue should approach. So the Gemara understands that to mean, mi bal dvarim yigash ray aleihem. Whoever has something that he wants to accomplish, he should bring the proof in order to accomplish that. It's an interesting question in general. You have a pasuk and you have a svara. So it's a whole separate discussion. I don't know if anybody here was at the Rav Shechter's introduction to Bava Metzia at the beginning of the Zman. I think he talked about this. I'm not sure. I think he talked about this point. That here it's not clear. So this din hamotzi mechaver lo haraya, on the one hand, the Gemara presents it as logical. And the Gemara also brings a pasuk for it. So there's a discussion in the Achronim what exactly is the conclusion on this point. And there are some who suggest that there are two levels here. That there is a basic svara, but the halacha of muchzak, which is the opposite of mamotzi mechaver ol haray, it's the other side of the equation. So muchzak that's derived from this pasuk is a little bit more powerful than that which svara would have told us. So too, you could say here, this is the point that Rav Yaffe makes also, that when we talk about muchzak, we talk about somebody holding on to something. So you could mean it in two senses of the word. You could mean the absolute halachic muchzak, he really owns something. We really recognize his bialis. Or we could mean that it's not that he's actually a muchzak, but there's enough to invoke the svara of Hamotzi Mechaver Ol Haraya. And the Gemara has a svara before it has the pasuk, or separate from the pasuk. So once you have somebody who's a player, so then it's logical you have to have a raya in order to challenge him. So it could be that there's enough of a oaks in here to rise to that level, but it's not necessarily the same thing as muhza. So we could have different levels of muhza, which correspond to different levels of oxen, which could correspond to different degrees of certainty when we talk about echloku. It makes a lot of sense to say that there's more than one track here. Depending on which direction you're coming from, you could say it in different ways, but there are a number of reasons to say there's more than one track. There's a more solid echloku, and there is a kind of more wishy-washy, pshara-like yachlok. So if you look at the simanim question, right, the question of the two parties who each have a simon, and therefore we leave it standing, we don't let either one get it. So some achronim approach this question and they say that this is a din that is particular to Hashabbos Aveda. And when it comes to Hashabbos Aveda, we have a specific prohibition, which the Gemara in Eilu Metzias will also tell us, that you can't return the Metzia to a Ramah. That's why you have to ask for Simanim in the first place. So some Achronim say that that's what's going on here. It's a unique requirement of Hashabbos Aveda, that we're even more sensitive to potential Ramos, and therefore, even if we would have allowed Yachloku, we can't hear because it's a Hashabbos Aveda situation.
Okay? Is that what the Kiddush Yaakov was about before, where he said that the Nifkat has an obligation to give back to a person?
It seems to parallel that, right? The idea that we mentioned, the distinction last week or before that, between a merchant who has to decide who he agreed to sell something to, or a nifkat, somebody who's watching property on behalf of two other people, so that person took on a charias that the merchant doesn't have. So here as well, you might say it's equal or greater than that. Right? So we know that a motzi aveda is considered to be a shomer, so he's like a nifkat. It's interesting, the Gemara has a whole discussion about that, so but outside of our topic. But the Gemara tries to figure out what kind of a shomer aveda is, the Gemara in Baba Kama. And so we know that if you found some property, you're obligated to watch it. So the Gemara wants to know, it's machlokas in the Gemara, does that mean you watch it like somebody who's paid to watch it? Or like somebody who's a shomer chinam? You're not taking any payment, so you're watching it like a shomer chinam watches it. So we see from that discussion, we actually paskin that he's a shomer sacher. And that's the whole discussion in the Gemara, why that is. He's not really getting paid, so why is he considered to be a shomer sacher? So you see that the motzi aveda is for sure a shomer, and more than a shomer, somehow the mitzvah ratchets him up a little bit more. So certainly whatever achrayis the nifkat has, the motzi aveda has, and especially also because the Gemara darshans that drosh achicha, that you have to darshan, you have to be dorish the person to make sure he's not a rami. So you could say on top of that, there's a specific obligation that you have to make sure that the person is not a rami. So some achronim say like that, that Gemara reflects this unique aspect that the shomer aveda has. However, what's a little bit difficult about that? Well, as we mentioned, it's not clear that there is a rami here. Maybe they're both telling the truth. Right, maybe they're both actually believing that they lost this property, they lost something that looks like it. And we don't necessarily have a rami. Hi?
Yeah, but if the guy has a responsibility to return it to the doctor, to the owner, then even if they're not lying, it's me not fulfilling my responsibility as a shomer aveda.
Oh, so that's another approach. It takes it a little bit of a notch further. It's a different nuance, but it's very similar. But that's how some others want to suggest. But maybe you could say, all right, the Rami thing is one issue, and that may or may not apply here. But you still have the mitzvah. And so the mitzvah should perhaps dictate that maybe I have to do a vadai fulfillment of Hashabbos Aveda in order to fulfill it. And maybe because of the mitzvah, I don't have the right to make up shari here. I don't have the right to split the difference, but I have more of an obligation, not necessarily from the Ramos part, but because of my mitzvah. It's a decent suggestion, and there are those who want to say that as well. It's a question whether it's true or not. There's a Gemara, actually, should have put on the Marmakomos, I don't think I did. But if you take a look, there's a Mishnah on Bava Basra, in Bava Basra, Daf Chav Gimel Amud Beis, where the Mishnah talks about if somebody found a bird. So let's say you and I both have bird coops on our property. And a bird was found closer to one, closer to the other. So the Mishnayos there talk about the one that has the bird coop closer is the claim to the bird if you can't identify where it comes from. So the Mishnah says, what happens, I really should have put this on because it invokes our key word here, take a look, of Gimel and Beis and Bava Basra. If you have a bird that is found equidistant between two people's bird coops, so what happens? So here it sounds like this is the Hashabbos Aveda kind of situation. Now you're trying to figure out who the owner of this lost bird is. And despite the Hashabbos Aveda situation, apparently we are okay with making a pshara in such a case. So while it makes sense, as far as compelling, to say that maybe we can't make a pshara if we have this mitzvah of Hashabbos Aveda, it could be, but it's not clear that it's true, and it's not clear that it's consistent with everything that we see in Mishnayos. So it's a question whether either of those approaches necessarily can satisfy us. But it could be that maybe we could suggest that this, and this is along the lines of something that we've mentioned already, so this is not necessarily such a new idea, but it could be that when we have this pshara of Yachloku, so even if we don't have actual ochsa, And so Ochsen maybe can give us grounds to have a legitimate Yachlokum, a Vada Yachlokum. But even the lowest level, the Pshara, so we need to have some basis in order to make that Pshara. And therefore, we need to have at least defined set of players. Right, this we mentioned last week is the way that many understand the Rambam. That the Rambam doesn't even require Ochsen when he talks about the Arema. But we have to at least have a set group of players. We have the two people who are on two sides of the pile. As opposed to, let's say, the Arba, the boat, where you have two people claiming the boat. But who knows, 10 other people could come and claim the boat. There's nothing about either party that gives them particular connection to this boat. So this could also be reflected, as Rav Yaffam points out, there's a Tosfos on the first daf of Baba Basra, which once upon a time was on Mar Mekom, I don't remember what day, but it was there somewhere, that the first daf of Baba Basra, so there's a Tosfos that talks about the wall between two neighbors. And the wall collapses. So the Mishnah says that if the wall collapses, so the rocks, the material, whatever it is, and the place where the wall is, so that is split up between them. So Tosfos over there asks, what's the difference between that and Arba? What's the difference between that and the boat? In the case of the boat, we say Kol Dolim Gvar, and here with these rocks, we say Yachlok. So Tosfos suggests, well, it's a Drara D'Mamona issue. And we still have to hopefully by Wednesday also fill in a little bit more about what Drara D'Mamona is going to mean for us. We see that's a major machlokus in Rishonim. It seems to be some basis to see a pre-existing suffix here, so to speak. So in the case of the collapsed wall, that's a Drara D'Mamona case. And in the case of the Arba, it's not. So how do we decide that? How do we decide one is Drara D'Mamona, one is not? Even if we haven't settled on a definition of Drara D'Mamona, so let's call it X. Right, so let's just say that, okay, in the case of the wall, you have X, and in the case of the boat, you don't have X. What's the difference? So Vaday Ramay, not necessarily, the boat is Vaday Ramay, that's interesting. Although that's not what, apparently what Tosfos is suggesting, because they could have called that Vaday Ramay if that's what they wanted to say. So what are they focusing on here when they use our mysterious X factor of Drara D'Mamona?
No players involved.
Ah, so that seems to be what's going on here. Right, we have a wall that's between two people. So we know who the players are. We know that it's either this neighbor or that neighbor. And that will give us enough reason to make the Yachloku Pshar. While in the case of the boat, again, we don't have these fully defined players. So now, if that's the case, so now let's... Yes, sir?
So I'm confused by the case of the haystack, where we say that the... you know, the Rambam there says, do we know there's defined players there? Whereas by the boat, there's not. Who's to say that...
Right, so this again, we discussed that a little bit last week. It's not totally satisfying, but we have to assume that the haystack is, which is a good English word that we haven't used yet, presumably is connected to their workspaces. So they have a pre-existing connection to those locations, just not actually making a chazaka in a physical sense on that stack of hay. So we know that these are the people who work here, these are the people who are inhabiting this area. And it's not simply that they're walking past it. The case of the boat. So the boat is in a dock, a public dock, and somebody comes and says it's mine, somebody else comes and says it's mine, maybe 10 other people will come and say it's mine. So in the case of the Aveda and the Simana, so let's think about it a little bit more. What exactly is the status here? Do we know who the players are? What exactly is going on? Right, so how exactly should we look at this Aveda situation? You know, Jonathan and I discussed this a little bit during Seder. We talked about if you want to try to see what the difference is here in terms of the Aveda and other things. So we could focus on a number of different details. Right? We could look at the Shomer Aveda and see if he has different responsibilities than anyone else involved. maybe his mitzvah gives him different responsibilities. Or we could also look at the evidence. And this gives us also great opportunities, again, for synergy between the first parak and the second parak. But what's the power of simanim? Right, we're assuming that simanim, together with the third party watching it, makes this ochsin. But ochsin is only relevant if there's some connection to the litigants. Right, Tosfos is chiddush on that base that the shomer is also called ochsin. Right, not only do we have the two parties physically holding on to the talis, but even if a third party is holding it on behalf of them, that's also called ochsin. That was a chiddush if you think about it, right? Because we don't have the physical holding on by the litigants. So it's only because he's acting on their behalf that makes him ochsin. So here, the Shomer Aveda is ochsin on behalf of who? On behalf of the rightful owner. Who is the rightful owner? So we don't know who the rightful owner is. Right? So we have two people bringing simanim. So simanim gives you some claim to being the rightful owner. How strong is that claim? Is it as strong as the claim of the two parties who gave over the manashlishi and we know they're the only two players? How does simanim compare in terms of standard of evidence to ochsin? What do you think? How does it compare? What's the power of simanim? Hi.
I mean, I certainly don't know, and I can see the argument on both sides, but I think that you can say that it does equate relatively well just because there's a yeish factor for all those who aren't coming up with simanim. So even though generally you would say like it definitely belongs to somebody, and here there's a multitude of people that aren't approaching with simanim, but the fact of the matter that they aren't means that, okay, so it's more like, you know, it approaches the level of being found at one or two people.
Okay, so if we made a, if we were, we do have a achrazah here, so we do have an announcement, right, saying the whole world heard this announcement, so two people came forward and the rest of the world didn't, so then there's a yeyish factor on everyone else's behalf, so we've kind of narrowed out the playing field. That could be, that's interesting. I have to figure out if that's true or not. See, it's interesting. Before, we haven't learned all of Eilu Metzias, so without knowing anything about the qualitative nature of different simanim, and some simanim are better, and some simanim are less good, and we talk about simanim also in terms of other areas of halacha. The Gemara says, let's say you have Rahman al-Slan in a guna situation, or you have a man who is missing, and we don't know if he's dead or not, and you find a body, and we don't have enough evidence to conclusively say who it is. So we talk about simanim there also. We talk about indications that it is the person. And there's different levels of simanim. There are simanim that are very compelling. There are simanim that are less compelling. Because there are things that are unique to this person. And there are things, if you find the shoes. So how many people in the world had this kind of shoes? It narrows it down, but it doesn't necessarily say it has to be this person only. So without getting into any previous knowledge about different levels of simanim, what can we see within this case? Both parties come with a simon. So how conclusive is the simon? Can't be that conclusive. Right? Because at least one other person has the exact same evidence. So on the one hand, you could say, which is what Jonathan is getting at, so it's the same thing as the talis. Two people come with the same evidence. Except that there it's better because we can look and we can see who the two people are. Here, if both people could come with the same evidence, that itself shows us that it's not exclusive evidence. And for all we know, there could be a third and fourth and fifth person with the same evidence. So once we have two people who can make the same claim, and we can't see who the playing field is, like we can with the talis, so for all we know, there are dozens of people with the same claim. So the very fact that each one has a simon negates the value of the other one's sentiment. So essentially, these people are no longer special. No offense. And these people are no longer unique. So essentially, maybe that puts us in a Yehei Munach situation, that we don't have the basis to, maybe we don't have an Ochsin really now, because the third party is Ochais on behalf of the rightful owner. And we don't know who that is. So that's essentially nothing. So we say we don't have Ochsin. So there's no Ochsin to say that there's a legitimate Yachloku. So what's left is Yachloku as a Pshar. But to make the Pshar, we have to at least know who our parties are, to say, you are going to be our Pshar parties. And we don't any longer know that these two people are the only players at the table. So it could be that that could explain why, and this is again the point that the Rav Yaffe discusses, why the Simanim case doesn't necessarily fit in. What about the shtar situation? Right, you have two people wishing on the same shtar, so one is the Malva, one is the Lova, and we saw that that was the Yehemunach situation. And you could have said Yachloku there, right? So there we clearly do know who the players are. We have Mel and Louie, those are the two people involved. That's actually better to find than other cases. There's really no other person. It's either Mel or Louie who's right, or somewhere in between. But there's no third individual who we have to worry about. So it actually seems like a pretty good Yachloku Pshar case. So it's actually a pretty strong question. Right, so if we say that Yachloku with Ochsin and Yichol Yilos Emes, right, it really does kind of match Tosfos' model. Right, Tosfos on the Beis of an Aleph in Bava Metzia, if you recall, so Tosfos said, how come we don't say Yachloku by Mona Shlisha? You have two parties who gave different amounts of money to a third one. In their mind, you should have said Yachloku. And why don't we? Why should we have said Yachloku? Because they said it is Ochsin. You have somebody watching it on behalf of both parties. Check, you have that here also. Why don't you say Yachloku? So Tosfos on that bay sounds like in the Mona Shlisha case, it's essentially Eina Yecholios Emes. It's essentially not a situation where it could be Emes, because it's unlikely that somehow it transferred ownership while it was in the party of a third person. So here, that variable shifts. It's not so unlikely. This guy borrowed money from the other guy. Louis borrowed money from him. Well, maybe he did pay back afterward. So if you take Tosfos' explanation of Mona Shlisha and you apply it in this case, it does seem to be a pretty good Yachloku candidate. Nope.
In general, is there a way to know if someone paid back half?
Well, no, we won't know. That's the thing. So we'll say that since we don't know, if we knew, then for sure we would have stacked on it. So we don't know, but it's possible. So then it's a split, we make up Shara, that could be MS.
But in a regular case, he owed him at that point. How would we ever know? He's never going to give him the Shara until he pays back the whole thing.
Correct, right. He doesn't have protection. So that's the Gemara discussing this. We have a new Shara, we have a Mashma, there are ways to address it. But in this situation, we don't know. So let's say there is no conclusive proof one way or another. So it's not impossible for it to be MS. It's much more likely. In the scenario that Tosfos says it's just too unlikely to factor in. And you have the same type of chazaka of Ochsin that Tosfos talked about in Mona Shlisha. So it's not an easy question to answer, but there is an approach that Nesivos has, which kind of just takes it out of the playing field. But Nesivos says that maybe there's a completely different angle to address this. And you could say that the fact that the Shomer doesn't recall what the story is with his shtar, so that itself undermines the shtar. That itself makes the shtar less effective. The Shomer who was holding on to it, who was asked to watch it. So since he doesn't remember what had happened, what's the history, so then that makes it a little bit wishy-washy. And maybe we're worried that the shtar is either a shtar parua, that it was paid off already, or maybe it was a fake shtar. Maybe it was a shtar mezuyev. So in other words, since we're worried about how valid the shtar is, so when you say Yehei Munach in this case, you're really giving the advantage to one party. Which party? To Louis. Because if you don't act on the shtar, so then Louis doesn't have to pay anything. So you're really benefiting him. So that's the Nesivos' point, that essentially we're not really so sure the shtar is a valid shtar. The circumstances cast a little bit of doubt on how valid the shtar is. So that's why we give the edge to the lovet. So it sounds like, his point being, that's kind of a left field type of answer that comes out of nowhere, that brings in new considerations. Dov doesn't like it at all. Now you want to suggest a different approach? You want to address that? You're just not happy with Nesivos? Ain't Nesivos Seh Hashom. But he's not happy with that answer. But the point being that the Nesivos, whether or not you like his answer, his approach kind of respects the question, which is a point that Rav Yaffe makes, that seems to be that you're right, Meikar Adin, this Din in Shulchan Aruch seems to be a very good Yafloku candidate for at least Tosfos' view. And you need some type of left field answer to say that this is somehow different. But other than that, you could have said Yafloku. That was the first thing. Chazaka in his original one.
Why is there a good reason to say that it's for that?
See, I don't blame you for not necessarily being convinced, but other than that, so we have to do Yafloku on the answer, because we're left with a difficult question. So his point is that the Nesivos, as unsatisfying as that approach may be, it leaves the basic hanafa that you're right, Meikar Adin, this could have been a Yachloku case, because it follows our rules. We know who the players are, and we have at least basis for a Pshara Yachloku. It's not going to be a Vada Yachloku, but it could have been a Pshara Yachloku. Jonathan?
It fits very well, I think, with Kilos Yaakov on the Rush, who explained the whole idea is that you know that the Shomer, at least, or the shopkeeper, would know that it's a case of Evans.
So in that case, right, let's see how that fits in. So he's saying that in the case of the Nifka, not with the shopkeeper, right, doesn't know. He knows that he didn't agree to both of them.
Right, so in that case, since he knew it was going to be, since he was the one who was doing the arrangement, that only one person had it.
Right.
So that's what facilitated, in that case.
So it didn't allow Yachlok.
Right, so Sarwatir also was totally on the third party. He was able to facilitate, because he knew whether or not it was...
His lack of knowledge is taken into account.
Like the opposite.
Right. The fact that we take into account what he knows and what he doesn't know. So since he doesn't know, that casts an aspersion on the whole.
It's the opposite conclusion.
Okay, could be. It's somewhat correlative.
I'm not sure I completely understand this argument of Nesivos as to why.
David's very with you on that.
No, I don't know if it's exactly the same point, but why is that? When it comes down to this sort of suffix, we end up saying that, okay, so we'll give the edge to the lobe and just say, what's the star for that?
Well, because it highlights an element which has not been focused on so much, that Yehi Munach, in this case, normally Yehi Munach really is supposed to either help or hurt both parties equally. And both parties lose out because it's Munach or however else you want to look at it. But in the case of a shtar, where you have a lender and a borrower, so here, Yehi Munach is not really a 50-50 or an equal opportunity act, because it happens to help one party and hurt the other party.
Yeah.
So that itself reframes the question, right? Because that itself makes you realize that if you're going to say Yehi Munach here, it's already fundamentally a different Yehi Munach. Because in the case with the Manish Lishi, so Yehi Munach, I'm saying you two guys can't stop fighting, so you're both going to lose out. It's going to stay on the shelf until we figure out what's happening here. But in the case of the Shtar, so that's not what the message is. The message is, oh, you two stop fighting, you're going to lose out. The message is, okay, now the Malva, you lose out, because you can't collect on this. So Lova's very happy. So that's already a core reason to question this whole psak. If you think about it more, right, it undermines the whole premise of Yehi Munach. This is already not a normal Yehi Munach.
Yes, but even
right? Because that it doesn't affect both parties equally.
But even in the case of Manashlishi, there has to be one person is correct.
Right, but so here
there's going to be one person who is getting,
it's going to end up. There's going to be a loss, but the loss is just that this item doesn't get returned to either party. So I have
it was one party's item.
Right, but having an iPod, the iPad will stay in escrow. It's not going to go to either party.
Right, here it's my iPad. I'm losing the iPad.
Correct, but that the item is still already outside of them. The item is already what we're holding on to, and it's the question of who to give this item to. But in the case of the shtar would then be used to extract money from the other party. So the fact that we put it aside means it's not going to be used to extract money from anybody else. So I win by having that shtar put aside. In a normal Yehi Munach case, if you and I are fighting over some object, and let's say I'm a Rama, right? So I will not gain anything by having it put aside, and you won't get the property you're trying to claim, which means it's ultimately a loss to you, but that's already outside of your shoshana.
Right, so I understand the difference like in the cases, I just don't understand why.
So that, that itself
makes a difference.
Like, so that itself just reframes the whole issue, because that itself shows you that this is already not a classical Yehemunah kind of psak. It has a disparate impact. So then the question becomes, so then why are we allowed to have a disparate impact? Why should we say that the Lovish should be better off than the Malvin, this kind of a psak? So presumably that's what then leads the Nesivis to say, because Hamotzi Mechavero Olavaraya, and so if you want to make the guy pay, so you have to have a shtar that establishes that he has to pay. And the circumstances of this ending up in a third party who doesn't know what the story is, so it makes the shtar kind of an iffy shtar. Because the fact the shtar exists doesn't mean anything. Because it could be that he paid for it already. So maybe the shtar represented a loan that's no longer current. So its existence is not a very strong proof that there's a debt. So if it was in the hands of the Malva, so then that would show us something. But it's in the hands of a third party. The third party doesn't know what the story is. So then this is now weak evidence. So weak evidence, we can't use that to be motzi min ha-motzah. So the shtar will yehei munach. So it's a different kind of yehei munach than the other types. But if the shtar was really something that we took seriously, if it was really something that put a real suffix out there, so then it could have been a good Yachloku case, because we have two people who are the clear parties, and we have Ochzin on behalf of these two parties, and therefore we could have said Yachloku. And it's only because of the unique components of this case, that the shtar is what's driving things, that that makes us come to a different conclusion. Yes?
The Sivas
is, I think, commenting on that, Shulchan Aruch over there in Samachei Aleph. I think it should be there. Okay, so everyone more or less follow that. Again, the Nesivis has aroused some opposition, but separate from that last point, the Nesivis. So let's just maybe quickly review what we spoke about, and then we'll just try to set the stage a little bit for Kol Da'avim Gvar, which we'll discuss tomorrow. We'll try to get down the fundamentals, the shorter Seder, shorter Shir tomorrow, but hopefully you'll have time to finish up or make some progress in the Marmakomas from today, and then we'll try to lay out some of the fundamentals of Kol Da'avim Gvar, and we'll see also how it could parallel in some ways the discussion of Yachloku. And what you'll see also, it's a very smooth segue from one topic to the other, that one of the major Makoros that's on today's list in terms of Kol Da'avim Gvar is the Rambam's treatment of that same Gemara we've been talking about today, about the Simanim v'Simanim. So how the Rambam addresses that Gemara that we've just been talking about is going to impact on our understanding of Kol Da'avim Gvar, and we'll probably get to that tomorrow. So we'll just, I think there was a question over here. We'll just, somebody had a hand up over here? I'm making that up. Okay. So let's just review what we spoke about a little bit, and then let's try to, maybe if we have some remaining minutes, to try to lay out some of the issues that we'll try to clarify tomorrow. So, what did we see? So, we started talking about the presumption that there is more than one type of Yachloku, that there's a Yachloku that is more definite, more real, and there's the Yachloku that is more of a compromise or a pshara, however you want to translate that term. And certainly, if you allow Yachloku without Ochzin, as the Riva does, right, the Riva really forces us to say there's two types of Yachloku, because he pretty much says it straight out. As far as Rishonim are concerned, the Riva is really the one who says this most explicitly, because he says you don't need Ochzin, and then you just need no rabbi, and if you have Ochzin, then you don't need to not have a rabbi. So he really paves the way to say two types of Yachloku. And if you don't need Ochzin for one of them, so then that really seems like a pshara, and that seems like the view of the Rambam as well. With the haystack, that you don't have actual achiza, yet you have Yachloku, presumably as a pshara. So we consider that question in light of some other cases, the case of simanim v'simanim, two people come and both have simanim over an object, so the Gemara says, we leave it. Even though you could have said, well, the Shomer Aveda is holding it on their behalf, and there's no definite Rami, they may both think it's theirs, and also in a separate track, Echolios Emes, because it could be their co-owners. So why don't we say Echloku? That was a previous question. And then we mentioned also the case of the Shtar, that is in the hands of a third party, the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch, that we say Yehei Munach, if we're not sure if it was paid off or not, so why again don't we say Yachloku, especially because of Chol Yosemes, it could be that it was half paid off. So we mentioned, and Rabbi from Yafin formulated, again, it's very consistent with the way many others have addressed the issue, that presumably there's two tracks of Oxen, there's two different ways you can be holding on to something. There's ways that it's more conclusive, it's really an anan sadi that it's yours. And there's also a way that's less conclusive, it doesn't necessarily say as much as it may otherwise. And we discussed the Gemara Bava Kamma, which out of all our categories is the only one to really bring a pasuk as a source for anything that we're talking about, that considers a pasuk for Avotzi Mechaber Lohoraya. And the Gemara there mentions both a svara and the pasuk. And we discussed that there's some question if they both accept it together, that maybe the Svara takes you to a certain point and the Pasuk takes it further. And so too, you could say there's different levels of Muchzakus. You could say there's a real Muchzak, which the Pasuk is referring to. And then even if you don't have a real Muchzak, so there's enough to provoke the Svara that you should have to have some kind of proof if you're going to take something away from somebody who's holding something. Then within that framework, so we tried to figure out what exactly is going on here. And we discussed some of the possible approaches to the Aveda Gemara. We discussed the idea that maybe it's particular to the responsibility of the Shomer Aveda not to give to a Rami. But we mentioned that here it doesn't seem so clear that there is a rabbi. It's possible that there's no rabbi. We mentioned also the suggestion that maybe even if there's no rabbi, still the obligation of a Shomer Aveda is to be more careful, and he can't make up shara or he can't return it misafek, similar to the Shomer of the Mashkon. But we saw that it's not clear that that's true. That seems to be against a Mishnah in Bava Basra about the bird. So we then noted that the svara that others had said as well, that presumably in order to do the pshara, even if you say you don't need oxen, even if you say like the Rambam, presumably in order to do the pshara, we have to at least have a set cast of characters. We have to have a way of figuring out who it is who's part of our story and who's not a part of our story. And that's probably also reflected in Tosfos and Bava Basra on Daf Beis, when Tosfos asked the question, what's the difference between the collapsed wall and the boat case? And Tosfos says, well, that mysterious X factor, Dror's Mamona, one has the X factor, the collapsed wall has an X factor, and the boat doesn't. So what's the difference between the two? Presumably the X factor is that we have a set group of players. We have two neighbors here. It's clearly that's the whole cast. And in the case of the boat, that's not necessarily true. So when it comes to the case of the Aveda, the Simanim, so the effect of the Simanim, we have to figure out, is that like Shneim Ochsen, so each one has some claim, so through here each one has some claim? Or maybe not so. Maybe we're not, even though we're not convinced with a Shneim Ochsen Batalis how significant it is, but at least we have a defined cast of characters. In the case of the Aveda, so the simanim, by their very nature, clearly are not exclusive, because if each party could have the same simon, so then that shows you anyone else could have it as well. So they presumably negate each other, and that means our cast could be unlimited, so maybe we don't have the right to make that pshara between these two people, when who knows who else may also be on the horizon. And then we discussed back that case about the shtar, and the shtar really would seem to fit a lot of the requirements for Yachloku then, based on what we're saying. We have a very defined cast of characters. We have Ochsin through the hands of a third party. We have Chalukah Yecholios Emes. That should at least be the grounds to have a shara of Yachloku. And maybe the reason is that we mentioned the Nesivis, which raised some objection here, but that it seems to be we're giving the edge to the Loveh, and we're allowing him to go unbothered, and probably because the shtar is somehow a very weak form of evidence. What's weak about it? Well, because the existence of the shtar doesn't tell us that much, because it doesn't tell us that it wasn't paid back, and in the hands of a third party is itself ambiguous, and the third party doesn't know what's going on. All of that makes the shtar somewhat of a weak type of tool, and therefore we'll give the edge to the loveh, and we'll say, Yehei Munach. Yes, sir.
Isn't it also possible to sell a shtar so someone else
yes,
can collect?
Yes, it also could be. So then the question is going to be, but still, it should end up in the hands of the lover once it's paid. So the person who has it, so either he's going to be the malve, or he'll be somebody who bought it from the malve. But if the lover wants to be free, the lover should really have it. So if this third party is not claiming that he bought it, he's not claiming that he has the right to collect it. So then it still leaves us into a suffix position as to what exactly is going on.
I don't fully understand part of these kashbonos you're making, because it's only the Riva who has the two types of yachloku, or it's
explicitly.
Right.
Right. He's the one who has it most explicitly.
Because the Rebbeinu Tam, at least how he's quoted in Bava Basra Rabbatia, where it's only by Ochzin and Tlan, there's no rabbi.
Right.
But it would seem to be there's a case where there's Ochzin and a rabbi, or no Ochzin, so it seems to be Rebbeinu Tam saying
no yachloku in the first place. Right, except that in the case of, it says no oxen, right? In the case where there is oxen, so then most of the Rishonim should seem to acknowledge that there should be a local one.
I guess
we're going to talk
about the case of Machapar Machamra, there's no oxen there, and yet.
So that, right, that itself, you have to address. But in the case where you have oxen, and it seemed like if you accept Tosus's premise on that base, that you could have third party oxen,
right?
So then every case that we've seen today has oxen.
And I think it was about Basra, but the Riva disagrees and says that it's actually opposite by the Manishtish.
Correct, which is itself, but the Riva doesn't need Oxen to begin with. So either you don't need Oxen, like the Riva, or you do need Oxen, but then the cases that we've discussed have that type of Oxen. So it seems like they should all be valid candidates for Yachloku, either for one reason or the other. Either because you don't need Oxen or you have enough of an Oxen to count according to Tosfos. So they all seem to meet some standard. Okay, hi Jonathan.
Even according to the Rebbeinu Tam, where you would need, let's say, a second type of Ochsen, if you see it in his language, I think it says it's Kilu there, he's holding on to the third party, the first one. So it's sort of.
It's also a proof that we're talking about a weak Ochsen.
There's a different Ochsen type there,
So that's an interesting point.
Kilu.
Right, you're saying, so that itself. That whole language suggests that the Ochsen
is a different type of Ochsen.
Right, which it doesn't mean that it's different types than a Muchsa, but not necessarily different than Shnei Muchsen Metallus.
Right.
Shnei Muchsen Metallus, I'm not convinced that that's
the same.
Right, so Shnei Muchsen Metallus itself might be a weak Ochsen, a Kir Ochsen kind of situation. So maybe the third party is equal to that. They're both Kir Ochsen.
Okay.
But it's right. It's hard to say in general that the third party is a real Ochsen, and it's easy to lose track. You're going to say a third party is Ochsen, so who is the Ochsen on behalf of? So he's Ochsen, like so the Aveda, that is Ochsen on behalf of the whole world, then that essentially is worthless. And so his Ochsen on behalf of two parties, but one of them is real, so then that gets into a Shnei Ochsen Metallus kind of model. We have to somehow figure out who this Ochsen represents. Okay, any further questions on that? Everything makes sense more or less? Okay, so again, so what we'd like to do now is to kind of segue into Kol Dolam Dvar and Shuda and Yehei Munach over the next 2 days. So just before Mincha, let's maybe just spend a few minutes laying out some of the issues. So what are some of the central questions we're going to want to figure out in terms of Kol Dolam Dvar? So once we've seen that there are circumstances in which we're going to call upon that, if we want to apply how Kol Dolam Dvar works, so what are some of our considerations? Right, so first of all, you all, or some of you saw the tour. Right, what did the tour say that casts a negative light upon this whole sugya?
Without law, the only thing that takes any precedent is Kol Dolam Dvar.
Right, so you saw that the tour has an introduction to Chumash Mishpat, which is a widely quoted introduction in general because of other things that he says. And the Torah says that we need to have civil society, and we need to have law, and we need to have a system. We can't have anarchy, and if we don't have a system of figuring out things, we're going to have a situation of Kol Dolam Dvar. So Kol Dolam Dvar is presented in that context in a negative light. Now, we don't necessarily have to assume that the Torah is referring to our Kol Dolam Dvar. But either way, it invokes the term in a negative context, which is relevant. And the phrase, again, translates into might makes right. Might makes right is probably not what we would have invoked as the slogan of the Jewish people for many different reasons. It's not probably what we would have wanted to highlight as the Torah's key philosophy. So it's hard to reconcile. It's not irrelevant that that's the term, right? The idea that this is a term which either the Torah is identifying with anarchy or using it in a different context as anarchy, it reflects as something a little bit unsettling about Kol Dal Udvar, and it would make sense that perhaps we would want to relegate that to second best. Hi.
Does it seem like the Torah would hold that Kol Dal Udvar isn't like the just a psak Kol Dal Udvar, and then the first person to grab it gets it? Seems like his opinion of Kol Dal Udvar is the up and back, whoever can bring the or whatever.
So that's the question. That becomes the next question, right? Which basically then just becomes the mechanics. So what is Kol Dal Udvar? So we don't even know what the words mean. We don't even know what the process is. So we'll have to see. We'll get more into this tomorrow. The question of what is it that Kol Dal Udvar represents? Does it represent the actual let them duke it out, as it sounds? Or is it something more formal, which is a more legitimate process? So that's an interesting point. Now, what's interesting, this is something that Jonathan pointed out to me during Seder, is that who is the biggest advocate of seeing Kol Dal Udvar as more of a legitimate process?
Richard?
Well, Rabbeinu Tam on Yachloku. But in terms of Kol Dal Udvar, well, we read that into Rabbeinu Tam. But who is, in terms of explicitly, who gives the most credence to the system of Kol Dal Udvar? It's really the Rush. Right, the Rush is above Metzia and above Abasra, and elsewhere is also in the Tshuva, and we'll talk about that more tomorrow. So the Rush, on the one hand, being the advocate of Kol Dal Udvar as a actual system of justice, it's interesting because the Tur, being the son of the Rush, is usually influenced by the Rush's Pesach. So it is somewhat unexpected to find that the Rush's son is now using Kol Dal Udvar as the negative phrasing. So again, is he really talking about our Kol Dal Udvar, or is he borrowing the expression to mean anarchy? Either way, it doesn't put it in a good light. It's a little bit not so harmonious with the way the Rush understand. The Rush will be as far from that understanding of Kol Dal Udvar as any Rishon gets. So it's just interesting to see it disparate with the way the Tur uses the phrase. So that's an issue we're going to have to figure out. So tomorrow, we'll try to figure out what exactly is happening in Kol Dal Udvar. And then, also within that, and correlated to that, so what is Kol Dal Udvar in terms of hierarchy? Is it an action of Beis Din? Or is it an inaction of Beis Din? Does it have any correlation to actual truth? Or is it something that's essentially anarchic, but that's the best we can do? What does the Rush invoke, by the way, in defense of Kol Dal Udvar, if you've seen the Rush in any of his places? Right? I'm sorry? Oh, so that's one of the, that's going to be a side question also we'll have to get to, is that does Kol Dal Udvar go on forever? So once you say that the strongest gets it, so do we say that, okay, the strongest gets it, but then if the other guy gets stronger tomorrow, he gets it back? And then the first guy gets stronger on the third day, he can take it again? Or is there a limit? And the fact that Kol Dal Udvar would be seen as a din would indicate that it should be limited. You have one chance and that's it. So that's another issue. But how does the Rush explain why Kol Dal Udvar has some connection to truth? Jonathan?
Is this where they think that whoever really owns it is going to fight harder for it?
Right, so that's a fascinating idea. Right? Saying that maybe we could assume that the person who really is the justified owner, he's going to give it his all. He's going to put more energy into it. And that itself will result in greater truth. And he mentions as a corollary to that, that the one who doesn't own it, who's just faking it, so he's not going to be as committed as the other half, but also he's afraid because he knows that he doesn't have a solid case. So since there's always the possibility that some evidence will turn up against him, he knows that could happen because he knows he's not the real owner, so that also will weaken his approach, and therefore the alimus will indicate the winner. It's interesting if you try to correlate that to different psychological theories, what the Rush is basically saying is psychological umdana. There's a couple of different contemporary theories that would support that idea. One is, in general, there's a question in terms of people's honesty and dishonesty. So there's currently a lot of literature about the fact that people are comfortable, more people are comfortable with lower levels of dishonesty. The more dishonest you get, so then the greater challenge it is to people's personality. So people are ready, okay, to make one claim, it's mine, I'll say the claim out there, even if it's not mine, we'll see what happens. Then I have to go further, I have to start fighting it out. You lose your commitment to your dishonesty, and you have to be really a stark, dishonest person to really keep going, as you have to push it further and further. That's probably one component that's being addressed here. But there's also the component that, I don't know if this is necessarily relevant to the way the Rush came to his conclusion, but there's also a very real psychological reality called the loss aversion, that people are much more committed to not losing what they have than to getting what they don't have. So people would exert greater effort to hold on to their existing property than to acquire property of the same value. Loss aversion. People are avert to losing things. So the real owner is afraid of losing his actual property, while the potential ganav here is trying to pick up something for free. So the energy that will be devoted to holding on to that which is your own is stronger than the energy that is devoted to trying to get something which you don't have. So honesty issues aside, the one who's trying to profit something for nothing is going to be less committed than the one who's trying to hold on to that which he legitimately has. So I don't know if that's, again, why the Rush does what he says, but that's also an element that could support his idea that the genuine owner is going to be more passionate about this issue and is going to be stronger when it comes to Kol Da'olam Dvar. So all of this is going to play into a structure that we'll have to figure out what does Kol Da'olam Dvar mean. Once we know what it means, how does it fit into our classification of what Beis Din is doing or not doing? How does that affect its finality? And how will that affect when we apply it? You may have seen a major issue in the Shulchan Aruch and the Nosei Kelim in terms of what type of sveikis are susceptible to a psak of Kol Da'olam Dvar, especially in light of the Rush. Right? What about a sveika d'dina? What if the two parties are not arguing about facts? It's a question of halacha. And if everybody knows what all the facts are, there's no disputed facts. It's a question of what the halacha views as correct here. Do you say Kol Da'olam Dvar in such a situation? So you'll see tomorrow, if you get further than the Maamar Kolmos, this is a discussion in the Trumas Hadeshim, this is a discussion inside of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, so this also all flows from this question. So once we figure that out, we can also figure out whether there's only one type of Kol Da'olam Dvar, and also how the two systems are going to play off each other in terms of Yachloku and Kol Da'olam Dvar, and what if I want to choose one or the other, how will they influence each other, God willing, tomorrow. During our briefer time slot, hopefully we'll have time to get all of that in. Okay, everyone should have a wonderful day. Should be one of the good things. And I will see you.